I just kind of want to lay out what I want to accomplish with this. Thankfully, one of my strategic advisors, who's currently pining for a prestigious position on the board of Migdal HaTorah, came up with this topic. And it is an interesting topic because Kreskes is like a really profound Jewish thinker who there are those who surmise, had he written a sefer on halacha against the Rambam to match his sefer in philosophy against the Rambam, he might have dethroned the Rambam, meaning Kreskes would have been the guy that we would have had as our Mishneh Torah, so to speak, and not the Rambam. But he never got around to writing his book on halacha. Rather, he really, his book on philosophy, Or LaShem, is really, I'd say, his masterpiece. But he has a very, very unique view of free will. And I think the goal here will be is to, not this time, but in other words, probably in a couple of weeks, is to look from his perspective how he saw different theories in free will and how he was one of the earliest theologians to what it called to come up with an idea of compatibilism. Okay. Just if you have any questions, just what I'm going to try and do is I don't want to just lecture because I get bored. So what I'm going to try and do is I want to like hit certain points, and after those points, if you have any questions, ask, or you could put questions on the chat thing. That's the other thing. So either wait till I stop, and or there'll be a certain point where what it called where someone's noting that I'm spelling free will correctly. There'll be certain points where I think it's good to have discussion just to kind of get a sense of how we see things. So today I want to focus more on number one, just a basic sense of free will, really, really basic. And number two, we have to focus on on Sajagones, who was the earliest Jewish philosopher to really lay out the arguments for free will, and then really get into the Rambam to some extent, because the Rambam is the contrast to Kreskes. So we have to understand the Rambam's position, at least in the Mishneh Torah. Next time we'll explore in the Mor Nevuchim as well, to get a sense of what his position is and some of the pros and cons with what he held like. Okay, so let's start like this. So what makes this a little bit different than how I'd usually discuss free will is that when you argue about free will, okay, when you're arguing outside of theology, it's much different than when you're arguing within theology. And the reason is very simple, okay? When you argue for it outside of religion, so there's nothing compelling you to ever determine that free will is a valid option. Meaning what you could do is you're not bound by a certain result, okay? Instead of what it called, you can kind of come to a conclusion that free will doesn't exist. But it's really, really very difficult when you're arguing within religion, and you'll see some Sajagon soon. It's almost impossible within religion to come to a conclusion that there's no idea at all of free will. Now, to be clear, I don't want to just cut off the people who say things like free will is an illusion, okay? We'll get to the stupidity of that statement down the road, because it doesn't help by saying free will is an illusion. Free will could still be real even if you consider it to be an illusion. And I'll demonstrate that down the road. But the point is that when you're arguing from within a religious standpoint, it's really very difficult to not come to some type of conclusion of free will. So that's kind of what makes it a different type of argument. Again, if you bring theology into the picture, you're stuck. You're going to be stuck having to come to some type of conclusion of free will. And then when it comes to a philosophical discussion, it's very difficult because you're putting your conclusion in place first, and now you got to work the facts to get to that conclusion. And that's never a what it called. That's never a good way to do things. Hold on. Okay, so that being the case, what it called? One again, as I mentioned before, when you discuss it within the context of religion, okay, like one challenge you're going to face, for example, is how do you reconcile an idea of what the Torah demands, meaning the Torah is clear about some idea of free will, against the possibility of determinism, which we'll get to down the road, okay? What's really unique about Kreskes, as you'll see, is that Kreskes, again, being what's called a compatibilist, he's actually not afraid. It's a certain amount of intellectual courage that he has to accept a reality of determinism coexisting with free will. And we'll get to how compatibilism works in Kreskes again down the road. But it's really fascinating that he's willing to tackle that. Okay? Okay. So let me just start off with this first. I'm just going to get this one chunk out of the way, and then I'll open up the questions. So let's first, I always like to start off with discussing first what we want free will to be. Okay, there's a certain goal that we have of what we want free will to be. So we'll pick on Ariel Tucker as my example. So Tucker is walking along on his merry way in downtown Seattle, making his way to that area where cops are not allowed. As he shuffles, because that's what he does, through the barricades, he notices some looters harassing someone who runs a Starbucks. And if you want to engender more empathy, imagine the owner of the Starbucks is a Jew. Okay? So you see some of these anarchists harassing this Jew. Okay? Now, Tucker now has an opportunity to assist this shop owner by using his considerable strength to scare off the looters. Okay? At the same time, Tucker is quite hungry, desirous of some kale, soy, lentils, because he eats odd foods. Okay? So now, Tucker's stuck. Okay? In other words, again, he has in front of him, on the one hand, the opportunity to help out the shop owner. At the same time, he's hungry. Okay? So, what do we want free will to be? This. It would seem Tucker's now faced with two potential outcomes. Okay? The first is he chooses to assist the shop owner, which is a clear demonstration of his love of justice. Or he chooses to make his way through the area, ignoring the cries of the individual in favor of that scrumptious food. Okay? So the key here is that for Tucker, there are two potential outcomes. Now, whether those potential outcomes are actually in space-time or not, we'll get to. But for now, what Tucker believes, or he wants to believe, is that there are actually two potential outcomes. There is either assisting the shop owner, or there is continuing on his way to eat his food. Okay? That's what we want free will to be. Okay? So the way to picture it is that, what I've always draw this when I give this lecture, he's walking along a regular road, and then it bifurcates with two forks, okay? Each one is actually available for Tucker to take advantage of, okay? That's what we want free will to be, okay, ultimately. Now, what are the implications of this, okay? One is, one has free will if more than one fork of the road is open to the individual, meaning that as they walk down that road, so to speak, there has to be more than one option open. What would be the example where that wouldn't be the case? Okay, meaning one would not have free will if only one fork is open at any given time. So let's take Zev. So let's say Zev was thrown into the Migdal Heretic room, and unbeknownst to him, right, the door to that room was locked. So Zev did not know that. Okay, Zev spent a lot of time in the Migdal Heretic room, by the way, as an aside. So Granik spends a considerable amount of time deciding when he will leave the room or stay, meaning he's debating. He's debating, when should I leave? How long should I stay in the Heretic room for? I mean, he's got to do tshuva because he committed the sin of giving over a terrible svara. So he's deciding for himself, when should he leave or when should he stay? But of course, since we know the door is locked, the option of leaving is never actually available to Zev. Okay, so again, in this situation, so for Zev, right, in his mind, he may think that there are two forks available, but in, so to speak, quote-unquote reality, that's not the case. There's only one, which is he can't leave the room, okay? So again, if you take the idea of free will as being forks in the road, so this would be an example of removing the fork, where Zev thinks to himself that both forks are available, but in truth, or in what we'll call reality, that's just not the case, okay? Okay, just a couple more points, okay? As you will see, when it comes to the mitzvos, okay, free will is often considered, a necessity for morality to be relevant. This is a classic example. So for example, Josh, you really messed up. You should not have stolen the Tales of Chassidus book, okay? This implies that Josh should have done something else. So in a classic moral culpability argument, the first thing you say is, you should not have done X, which implies he should have done Y or something else, which implies there is something else to do, which means there is a Y, which implies you were able to do that other thing, okay? Thus, there's free will. So using, and this also has certain problems, but using the morality argument for free will is really this in a nutshell. It's all about, once you say you should not have done something, that by definition will lead you down a road to conclude that there must be something called free will, okay? Whereas determinism, okay, now, there are actually three kinds of determinism. I'm not going to get into them now, but there's what's called logical, epistemic, and causal determinism. And each one has their own specific definition. I'm not going to take that up now. I just want to get a basic working concept just enough for us to be able to understand what the Rambam's dealing with. Okay, so we don't have to take up, especially epistemic determinism, which will be very interesting. We don't have to get into that now. But basically, by determinism, okay, what does that mean? Only one continuation of the state of things at a given moment is consistent with the laws of nature, okay? So I'm kind of being a little vague about this, okay? But the key thing is that think about it from a pure physics standpoint, okay? At the moment of the Big Bang, the universe is created, so to speak, and time can only unfold in one way. Events can only unfold in one way, okay? So while you may feel that there are different possibilities, when I stand up and I'm at the mall and I want to determine whether I want pizza or shawarma, I may feel that both possibilities exist. In truth, physically, there's only one possible road for any decision. So again, going to the fork example, in reality, while you may think there are two forks off the road, in truth, there's only one. You perceive it as two, but there's only one. And then the only way the alternate possibility come into existence will be a violation of the laws of nature. Again, if in a physics deterministic view where time can only go one way, where history only unfolds in one way, so the only possibility of a different direction ever taking place or an alternate possibility would be a breach in the laws of nature, okay? Okay, I'm going to stop here. Now we get back into this. So compatibilism, right? And it's always important to look at it this way. Determinism and free will seem to be mutually exclusive, right? And yet compatibilism has emerged, actually it's a bad way to put it, it emerged centuries ago. And again, Kreskes was one of the innovators of this idea as a potential compromise, okay? Which, we'll get to when we get to Kreskes himself, okay? Okay, so what does Yehadis have to say about this? So once you bring in Jewish theology, the stakes change completely. And I want to just get through Sajagon's four arguments, and then we'll stop and take questions at that point, okay? So Sajagon presents four arguments for free will, okay? And I'm bringing the text in here, okay? The first one's based on experience, okay? As he says, all this is a Maimar Dalet, and he says basically based on my experience, right, that I'm able to, in other words, I feel like I can speak or I can be quiet, right? I can pick something up or I can put something down. So the fact that I feel that way, right, is a reasonable mechanism of saying that free will exists. Again, since I feel like I'm doing something, in other words, I feel like I'm making a decision, and like he says in the end here, I do not feel that someone or something is forcing me to choose. So just by my normative sensory experience of everyday life, right, it certainly feels like I'm able to make my own decisions. Now, of course, relying on our, and I don't mean this in a, when I say not relying on our feelings, I know there's an insinuation of a particular derech that this might imply. I'm not referring to that kind of feelings. I'm saying relying on our sensory experience alone can lead to all sorts of problems, all sorts of major problems. I think I had a discussion a while ago about like flat earthers. Someone was talking about it. Flat earthers commonly rely on the idea of the experiential, right? Meaning when I walk outside, it certainly looks like the earth is flat, right? To say I feel a certain way as to buttress the proof of a theory is a dangerous road to take, okay? But that's experience, okay? The second argument he makes is reason, okay? Now, again, you'll see the problem with the reason has one caveat, okay? As he explains is that he says it would make no sense whatsoever, okay, to have a God, okay, again, assuming God exists, and that there is such an idea of Hashgacha. So his reason argument is predicated on A, an idea of God, and B, that God interacts with the world. If that's the case, then it becomes absurd to have some type of idea, according to Rasajagon, to have an idea of divine justice if God is forcing man to act in a certain way. And that's what he lays out in this section in Maimar Dalet, right? The reward, so to speak, would be equal for the righteous and evil, right? And again, there is a little bit of moral culpability here that he's bringing out, but the main point is that if we accept the existence of God in Hashgacha, then what he's saying is that logically, or there's mina muska, meaning if you used your mind, it would be absurd to ever suggest that divine justice could ever work, okay? Does Hashgacha equal total control? Not necessarily, okay? Okay, so that's Sajagon's second argument, okay? The third one, this is what changes everything, okay? The third one's very simple. The Torah says so, right? Ha'idoshi b'chem ayom, es ha'shmayim v'sarei, tzadadad, right? Uvacharta b'chayim, right? So if you use the Torah as a proof, the entire nature of the argument changes, worse so than the argument based on reason. Because the argument based on reason, according to Sajagon, pigeonholes you into agreeing that God exists in his idea of Hashgacha. But this is even more potent, because if I say that the Torah is a proof, okay, then Once I believe the Torah is true, then I must come to some type of conclusion of free will existing. You understand? In other words, if I use the Torah as a proof of free will, then, in other words, think about the problem. The problem now is that, well, it can never be a, I'm going to say this carefully, an objective conversation about whether free will exists or not. You have to go into the conversation saying, I know free will is a solution, assuming that you learn uvacharta b'chayim in such a way, that free will is the necessary conclusion. And if it's a necessary conclusion, then you're going to have to start figuring out how best to make the theory fit that conclusion. But that's not always a good way to approach something in philosophy, okay? And finally, there's the Masoretic argument, which is basically, it says in the Torah, lo b'shamayim hi, right? And as we know, famously in the Gemara in Brachos, hakol b'dei shamayim chutz m'yirah shamayim. This actually serves as the foundation, right, as one of the starting points, not just what it says in the Torah, but for when the Rambam and others, when they point to the source of free will, they point to this idea, hakol b'dei shamayim chutz m'yirah shamayim. And Rashi there explains, right, which the Rambam echoes as well, right? Kol habal adam b'yad HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Everything comes to man from God, right? Like how tall you are, whether you're rich or poor, whether you're a chacham or not, etc. Except for tzaddik for Russia, okay? That's what's interesting. So tzaddik in Russia, righteousness and evil, is the one thing, so to speak, that is masur b'yadosh adam, that man has complete control over. So Rashi, what do you call it? You can make that argument too, yes. Rashi, in a sense, right, is forcing us, well, okay, I shouldn't say that. Rashi is explaining to us that free will in the Torah sense, right, is not the ability to choose ice cream flavors. It's really about tzaddik in Russia, okay? And the Rambam says the exact same thing. The Rambam in Shmona Parakim says, when it says akol, it says, man has no choice with how tall or short he's going to be, okay, or et cetera. Rather, the only thing he's, as you'll see in Hilchos Teshuvah, the only thing he has a choice in is going to be tzaddik v'rasha, meaning good and evil. So even in the Jewish version of free will, it's not an absolute free will in the sense of every choice I make. It's really rooted in good and evil, okay, which also presents certain limitations. That there is what Ariel's touching on is a really fascinating problem. The Rambam is dedicated to the idea that free will is localized in tzaddik v'rasha, right? But the question is that why does it have to be the case? And doesn't that create a very constricted view of free will? I mean, free will ends up becoming something where, as the famous question becomes, at what point is a person, I think Slotchy was saying this before, at what point is a person truly exercising their free will, right? Let's say, so the only thing I would say that would be an example would be an isser. So for example, right, if a person was about to, let's say, be Michal Shabbos, and there was Edim and Asra, right, there was witnesses and warning, you could make an argument there that the person's being presented at least with the good versus evil. Okay, so that might be the one. But again, you can argue what's motivating the person to act in a certain way. That's a very good question. Very good question. Okay, so now let's get into the Rambam. Okay, and this is probably the second half of what we want to focus on. We'll get a little more specific now. We got to go through the Rambam step by step to really get a sense of how he looks at free will, and I really want to focus on his answer to the problem of God's foreknowledge, which is going to be the crux of Kreskes' argument against the Rambam. So, Kreskes spends a lot of time challenging the Rambam's approaches in philosophy, okay? Now, a fundamental difference between the Rambam, and basically I'd say the majority of other Rishonim, is that the Rambam maintained that a person can understand Amitas HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the truth of God, through philosophy alone, okay? Meaning that the Rambam puts philosophy, so to speak, and the Emes Torah on equal planes. Or in other words, a person doesn't need to use Torah to get to the conclusion of God. He can simply use philosophy in and of itself. Now, when I say philosophy, I'm being loose with the term. The Rambam certainly sometimes leans more towards like what we will call a natural science approach, meaning, you know, like I see the wonders of the world and it leads me to the conclusion about God. The point is, though, is that he sees that avenue existing outside of the Torah. But Kreskes maintains that while the truth of Torah can never contradict philosophy, ultimately, philosophy will never bring someone to the complete truth of Torah. So what does bring a person to the complete truth of Torah? Divine revelation. That puts him much more in the Rav Yehuda Levi, Kuzari, Ramban type camp, which is that I need Ashgacha, I need some revelation of God to come to that conclusion. Okay? That being the case, okay, let's understand how the Rambam approaches free will. Okay? So he starts like this. We're going to start with Hilchos Tshuva. So in Perek Hei Hilchos Tshuva, the Rambam lays out as follows. He says, Rishus Lechol Adam Nesuna Imratzo Lahatos Atzmo Derech Tova Uliot Tzadek HaRishus Biyado Imratzo Lahatos Atzmo Derech Ra Lios Rasha Rishus Biyado. Note immediately that what does the Rambam say? Decision making has to do with good versus evil. Okay? It's an amazing idea. He does not say that free will or decision-making is in any area. He focuses decision-making purely in good versus evil. So going back to what was asked before, does that mean by definition if I choose to have steak instead of ice cream, that's not a free will decision? Okay? That's something to think about. Okay? And then he says, and he quotes a pasuk from the Torah. Okay? And he says, the other thing he says is, Kolomar, Hein min zeh shel Adam haya yachid ba'olam. Ve'ein min sheni domalo, bezeh inyan. So the other thing he focuses on is that free will is what is a defining feature of humanity. It makes humanity different than any other creature on earth, okay? But we're going to have to, that's the other point he makes here, but we're going to have to figure out at some point is, why is this so limited to good versus evil? Why is it a necessary concept in the Rama, okay? So he goes on to say like this. He says, Al yavor, now okay, this is the famous thing. He says, Al yavor machshavasecha davar zeh she'omrim tipchei umas olam rov golmei b'nei Yisrael. Note, by the way, it was a belief in both the non-Jews and among Jews as well. She'akadosh baruch hu gozer al adam mitchilas b'yasa liot tzadik ha'rasha. So never think, chas v'shalom, to ever enter into your mind that God decides man's fate, okay? Meaning God creates the person, and at the point of creation, it's already built in that he'll be at Tzadik HaRasha. Ein adavar kein. El kol adam roi lo liot tzadik, kemoshe benu, arasha ki ravam, ochacha mosacha, rachlam, etc. A person has within him the choice. He could be either a tzadik, right, or it could be a rasha. Now again, note the Rambam here is talking more about a character. It means your characteristics, not a maisa. He's not saying the action. He's saying you could decide what kind of person you want to be, okay? Ve'in lo, and there's no one forcing him. Ve'in lo mi shiakfu v'lo gozer love, right? V'lo mi shemoshka lecha mishnayat rachem. Eluhu ma'atzum midaito notel le'ezu derech shiyotze. So it's very famous, basically. It's clear according to the Rambam, going back to what we said before about free will, that a person has various paths open up to him, okay? You should never think he has got one fork. He has many forks available, okay? And not only that, nobody is forcing him down these various paths. So the Rambam is setting out what I would call the absolutist idea of free will. He wants this. This is the most, putting aside Tzadik in Russia, this is the most open and unbelievable version of free will possible. There are so many timelines, so many paths open up to the person. In quotes, so no one yells at me. Oh, actually, I'm not saying the word infinite. Countless, okay? There are countless paths available to the person to choose, okay? But, okay, here it comes, okay? He says, now he says, "V'davar zeh ikar gadol hu v'hu amud haTorah v'mitzvah shenemar reina sadeh v'necha yom esachayim." So the Rambam, just like Sajigon, says this is a foundation of Torah. Okay, again, just like Sajigon, he's using Torah as a proof, which again means not only is he showing you what does he want to appeal to you that there's an idea of free will. He wants to show you that the Torah says this has to be the case. Okay, but what does that lead us to? The famous problem. Okay, he says, "Uma makom haya l'chol Torah kula." The Torah would make no sense, again, just like Sajagon, it would make no sense if free will didn't exist. So far, he's echoing, in many ways, what Sajagon has to say. Okay? Well, it's pretty clear. Until he gets to this. Shema tomar v'halo kadosh baruch hu yodea komashia v'kodem shia yodea shezeh yet tzadik or rasha o lo yodea. Right? So, now you have the famous what's called the foreknowledge problem, which is very simple, okay? God knows everything. God knows what happened in the past and what's going to happen in the future. So therefore, he knows who's going to be at Tzadik and who's not going to be at Tzadik, okay? And you're going to be stuck because either you're going to say that God does know what a person's going to do. I'm just laying it out as Rambam laid out. He knows what a person's going to do. And then free will that's a challenge to free will because that means those forks in the road didn't exist, okay? Or am I going to limit God's omniscience? Meaning that if those forks do exist, that means God may not know what choice I'm going to make. So the Rambam presents, and by the way, this is used not just among Jewish theologians, but a lot of non-Jewish philosophers use the Rambam's presentation of the foreknowledge problem in their works. Okay, a lot of them do, because he puts it in such a beautiful, clear way. You're stuck. On the one hand, there's free will. On the other hand, we have God's omniscience. And it seems like these two things are not compatible with each other, okay? And again, I referred to this before. This is epistemic determinism, okay? Which really means knowledge of what someone else will do in the future is not limited to a deity, meaning the idea of foreknowledge isn't just exclusive to God. In general, there's a concept of, if I know for sure that, let's say, Tucker's going to go ahead and buy a pound of kale, even though Tucker is going to deliberate whether you will or not, I can have foreknowledge of such a thing. Such a thing could exist. So foreknowledge is not limited to a deity. So what's the Rambam's answer? And then we'll stop at this point and discuss this, okay? So first he starts off by saying, okay, he says that the Dash Chuvashe Lazu, Aruka Me'aretz, Mida, Urchava, Minayam, Vakami Karm Gdolim, Vaharim Mamam, Tulimba. So basically what he says is that the answer is extremely deep and difficult and complex and abstract, and every fancy word you want to use, the Rambam says that is the answer is something almost as if to say, almost impossible to understand. And yet, he says, he's very careful, he says, but you must know and understand what I'm about to say. It's like a funny thing. He wants to have it both ways, okay? It's clearly something that he's acknowledging is very, very deep, and we'll see if it's truly deep in a second. But the other hand, he feels obligated to make sure that everyone understands what he's about to say. So what is his answer, okay? So in the second parak of Hilchos Yisodei Torah, okay, the Rama mentions how God's knowledge, okay, he says, Shekadosh Baruch Hu Ein Yodea, now, Midia Shehi Chutz Mimenu, okay, Kibnei Adam, Sheheim V'daitam Shnayim. So whereas by a person, the human and his intellect or his knowledge are two separate things, God and knowledge, or his knowledge, are one and the same, okay? Elohu yis'ala shmo v'daito echad. Okay, so God and his knowledge are one. Vein daito shel adam yichol lahasik davar zeh al borav. And man, it's impossible for man using his knowledge to ever understand such a thing about God. U'kashem she'in koch v'adam lahasik limso amitas abore. So just like man does not have the ability to understand the truth of God, or the essence of God, okay? So too, kach ein koach ba'adam lahasig v'limso daitel shobore. We also can't understand, again, literally, right? We can't understand God's knowledge, in other words, how God knows, okay? So now that we cannot understand God himself, we can't understand what it means that God knows himself, okay? V'keman, at the last line there, v'keman shekenu, ein banu koach leida heach yodei HaKadosh Baruch Hu kol ha'burim v'maisim. And as a result, we don't have the ability to know how God knows everything he does about that which he created, okay? Yikes. What the Rambam's basically saying, before I turn it over to everyone else, okay, and you'll see there's some interesting problems with this, he's saying there's a famous idea in the Rambam, which is commonly known as the equivocal answer, which is that we use the word knowledge, right, as a word, okay? There is the human conception of what knowledge is. Then there is God's knowledge. But God's knowledge is something completely different than human knowledge. So even though we're using the same word, it really doesn't mean anything, so to speak, when we're describing God. Yet we still use the same word, okay? Humans cannot understand this idea of God's knowledge. It's an impossibility. So we cannot know what God's knowledge is, okay? So just like humans cannot understand God's knowledge, humans cannot understand how God understands his creatures, okay? Now don't feel bad, okay? The Rambam says, he says, we still have free will. So in his answer, he's saying, understand at the end of the day, even though we don't know whatever this God's knowledge is, it doesn't take away from this fact that we still have free will. Okay. So how does the Rambam solve the incompatibility? How does his answer solve incompatibility? Okay. That's the key here. How does it work? Does it work? Does this, how does this work to answer the idea of God's foreknowledge against the idea of free will, okay? I mean, what is the Rambam talking about? And by the way, this is a question that's bedeviled many, many, many great Talmid Chachamim. The Ravid attacks the Rambam. Basically, he, in, almost in a sense, mocks the Rambam because he says, we have to have faith in what, nerds. It's like a faith idea, just believe what he's saying. What is he talking about? What does this mean? What does it mean to say that that how does this answer the problem of incompatibility? I'll just leave it at that. So that's the famous So that's the famous answer to the question, which really is what you're really saying is that the question itself is an invalid question. So even though the Rambam himself asked the question, right? What he's saying is that it's an invalid question. But the question is that there's saying it's an invalid question. First of all, A, is that true? B, can we deal with the consequence of the Rambam's position? Because once you let's just understand, let's go down the road the Rambam wants in this reading of the Rambam, like you're saying, if you go down that road, well, then let me ask you a question. You'd have to acknowledge, which some definitely argue the Rambam says in the Mor Nevuchim, you have to acknowledge that any terminology used about God per se, right, is obviously inaccurate or gibberish. But not only is the positive, even the Rambam's treasured idea of negative knowledge is also gibberish. So let's say I say God is not X, okay? But even the terminology not X itself doesn't mean anything because God, the very term God itself has no meaning. All these words are literally gibberish. So the question is that are you willing to go down that road? Okay? Important point. An analogy would be that I exist, right? God exists. We share some type of idea of existence in common, but God's existence is of a different quality. But we share some reality of existence. The term can be applied both to me and God. That's not the Rambam's way. Right, that's what we want to think the Rambam's way is. What the Rambam really would say is no. He would say that the word existence means one thing for humans and means something completely different for God, right? And whatever that means for God, you can't really understand what that means because the very term itself will never adequately describe what God is. So when you say the word existence,